This episode of Linux Action Show is brought to you by GoDaddy.com.
And by Ting.com. Head over to last.ting.com and save $25 off your first device.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Linux Action Show, Season 28, Episode 2. My name is Chris.
My name is Matt.
Good morning to you, Matt.
Good morning.
I got a great show planned.
I'm looking forward to it.
Should we tell folks about it?
Oh, yeah.
So you and I have had one particular request come into the inbox over the years that we've really never gotten around to answering. One, because we didn't have a great answer for.
Well, it was kind of hard to bring it all together, right?
And then two... Oh, there's a little legal issues we have to dance around.
It gets a little gray, a little fuzzy.
This week, we're going to cover backing up and playing Blu-rays on Linux. And, you know, we've got the Blu-rays here. We're not talking about pirating, folks. We're talking about legitimately backing up the copies that you own of the content. Now, the Back to the Future set you've got right there, Matt. Not even kidding. It's almost like it was meant to be for this episode. Right. I rescued movie one from the clutches of my four-year-old last night.
Yeah, these are practical concerns.
I did pretty good, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I did pretty good. But the children love these things because they're shiny and you can throw them and you can hurt your siblings with
Ninja
them.
Frisbees, Ninja Stars, right? I mean, come on. Yeah.
And they break really cool, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
So, So this has become something that, you know, when you buy these things, like this is a $70 set, right? Star Trek, when it comes out, $100 a season. So you're talking, this is a serious investment. You want to make sure you have it protected. So we're going to talk about that. Then we're going to talk about protecting your wireless network by replacing the default firmware with a Linux-powered firmware that gives you a lot more options and gives you a lot more geek tools as well. Mm. I just recently reflashed my home router with a replacement firmware.
Nice.
And I'll tell you all about that.
Looking forward to that, boy.
Matt,
tell you.
In the news segment, we're going to introduce something new, the X11 Death Watch. We've got some stories. And it's not all—it's not all Wayland, but I'm going to warn you, Matt.
But it's Wayland heavy. It weighs heavy on my land.
It does
something.
Yeah. So I'm just want to let you know, Matt. Just preparing you for that. Then we've also got a great feedback segment with some really great questions that'll come up towards the end of the show.
Good
so heck
stuff.
Of a show, Matt. Heck of a show. Should we get started with the picks?
Let's rock and roll.
Now, I saw a couple of picks come in this week. It was really hard to choose. Now, remember, we brought it home last week with our pick. And there's some really great bringing home. I'm going to save those because we got one more this week that, sometimes Linux shows up on the map and they show up on the map in a big way. That's right. Our Russian ambassador, Steven Seagal, runs Linux. This was taken from a screen cap of
Think he would be more of a BSD guy.
One of his fine productions. Thanks to Amonima that sent
this in. Yeah, sounds right.
You can see right there, it looks like it's a little bit older version of Unity.
It is, totally, isn't it?
And what app is that? I can't quite make out. It looks like it's... I can't. That looks like a waveform right there, right?
Yeah, it looks like some sort of audio editor.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That looks like a map there. Anyways.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Huh. So I guess the people in the thread figured out that this is from his True Justice show, Angel of Death episode.
Wow,
never even heard of this until This put it on my radar, but people love it whenever there's a celebrity sighting and runs Linux, I get tons and tons and tons of email on it. So I figured we got to cover this one right now.
That's crazy.
Now it's not all roses for Runs Linux this week, man.
Uh-oh.
There's also a bit of a heavy one. The NSA.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, the NSA runs Linux. The KeyScore system that allows the NSA to filter and analyze all of the metadata collected is powered by a cluster of Linux servers, according to an NSA slideshow that came out this week.
Of course they have a slideshow for it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, on a Linux cluster. In one slide, they say it's 500 Linux servers.
Whoa.
In another slide, they say it's 400 Linux servers.
A little misinformation. That's what they do.
And this is from 2008, so now it's probably even greater than that. We covered more detail in Unfilter 61. We talked in NSA We Trust. We talked about the slideshow and kind of had some fun with the fact that it runs Linux.
Man,
you got your good things that run Linux,
right?
Like your Steven Seagals out there,
right? Yeah,
your
totally.
Russian ambassadors, and you got your
with
NSAs.
His running, you know, I mean,
right. He is a ninja, Steven Seagal.
You ever seen Steven Seagal run? If Google it and YouTube it, and you'll understand.
Really?
Now, those of you guys that know what I'm talking about are probably going, yeah, you understand. It's truly he kind of runs with his hands like a.
Oh, you're not kidding.
Yeah, no, I'm completely serious.
Oh, okay, here we go.
Yeah, he really, really... Yeah, this is just... he runs like a pterodactyl.
Boy, he's...
I mean, the man can move, and trust me, I'm not gonna tell that to his face.
He was fit back in the day, wasn't he?
Spin kick me.
He was fit.
Oh, he's very fit back in the day. Yeah, back. And as he's kind of like, you know, as his ponytail got a little longer, he got a little more of him. So,
oh, that's. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. He kind of. Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah.
So that we went down a rabbit hole I never thought we'd go down on this show. Steven Seagal does kind of.
Telling you. You know, he runs Linux, but he also runs with his arms flailing.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that, Steven. We're big fans.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. Okay. Some really fun picks this week. One that really fits in with our theme of multimedia and managing your media collection. And another one. Well, this one is something that it's an itch that I've been wanting to scratch for a real long time. Google's working on it with Chromecast. Apple has AirPlay. But
yeah, everybody's kind of got their own version or variation of
it. We've got a solution for you, too, Matt. We got a solution for you,
nice.
Too. But first, I want to thank this week's sponsor, GoDaddy.com.
Woohoo!
Now, I got some great, great news. Great, great news. So a lot of you know that I have a close personal friend, race car driver. She's associated with the world's largest domain name registrar. She does intros for Linux podcasts out there. Well,
that's
at least
right.
One Linux podcast.
She does a couple.
Yeah.
She does us.
Oh,
she does the,
I'm sorry, what?
the intro.
Okay.
The intro.
Okay. Right. Okay. All right.
Just saying.
Sure. Well, so you guys might have heard that our Linux 249 codes were about to expire last month. And so I'm talking with Danica last night. I mean, the race car driver that will remain anonymous. And I hear some thumbling.
Like a rumbling sound, like a thunder in the background. Sure.
I say, Danica, what are you doing?
Danica, what are you doing right now? She says, stand by, Chris.
And I find out she's broken into the GoDaddy data centers. Now, let me tell you, she had to use iris scanners. She had to defeat bodyguards, thumbprint readers, laser fields. But she is truly a data center ninja. She gets in there.
That's crazy.
And she stole more Linux 249 code so we can keep getting .coms. For $2.49, and I said, Danica, I mean, I really appreciate your super crazy ninja skills breaking into data centers.
I mean, look at the explosions, right?
Yeah, there's explosions, Matt. Exactly.
Goodness.
And you know, you got another bag of those Linux 249 codes. She's got a whole another bag of those Linux 249 codes. That's great. And I said, but look, can you go back in, Danica? Can you go back in because
kind of a Mission Impossible approach, right?
I got a code change idea. Mm. I know this is big. This is gonna require your deepest penetration ever, Danica, but I think I can help you with that. I'll give you all the information you need.
Okay.
Here's what she did.
Okay.
She breaks down into the data center from the roof.
Oh,
by
my
cable.
Goodness. We're talking like dangling and a whole bit.
Gets down to the keyboard and recodes the GoDaddy.com website.
Recodes
the GoDaddy.com website. So now it features the Express Pathway checkout when you're over at GoDaddy.com.
Nice.
When you're getting to .com, you will complete that purchase within just a couple of clicks. If you use the link in our show notes, Danica has set up express purchase pathways just for our viewers because she knows you guys are tech heads. You don't need all of the extra hand-holding and
assistance. You know what you want.
So just get in and get out. Get that .com for $2.49 when you use our code Linux249. And Danica set up that express pathway checkout if you use the link at the top of our show notes.
Nice.
Yeah. She also wanted me to remind you that she still made that Go32 off-to code work, too, if you want to take 32% off anything when you're over at GoDaddy.com. Go32 off-to to save 32% or Linux249 to get a .com. $2.49. And go use that Express Pathway while Danica still has that hacked into their source code.
That's right.
She's got it rerouted through their primary buffer system so that way they can't detect it. And then she has their PHP admin system locked in a continuous diagnostics loop. And then if you tweak it just right, Mr. Scott will materialize.
That's a neat trick.
She's pretty powerful.
That's pretty cool.
So thanks to GoDaddy.com and thanks to a certain unnamed race car driver for hooking us up with the special deals this week. That's awesome. I mean, we're really pulling out all the stops now to get
this stuff.
People got to take advantage of it while they can.
There's cable cords and explosions and all kinds of crazy things. And race car drivers.
Matt, ooh-wee. All right, you ready for my Android pick this week?
Oh, yeah.
You might have heard of it out there, folks. It's free. It's called VLC Direct Pro.
Oh, yeah.
And it allows you to take advantage of some of the cool features built into the VLC player on your desktop in a remote, handy-to-use package, a.k.a. your Android device.
Score.
So VLC has a lot of different interfaces available to it. Okay. If you bring up your VLC Media Player, Matt, are you familiar with
I am familiar with my VLC Media Player.
That was me delaying while I stopped.
That's right.
There,
no, but, I really appreciate my VLC Media Player.
Sure. It plays a lot of formats.
Absolutely.
So if you go into VLC and you hit View, Add Interface, Web.
Right.
you are able to remotely control the VLC program. And for you hacker kiddos out there, I've also included in the show notes a little command line. You just, this is what I did to make it work for Shizzles. And you run that. It starts up VLC. And then the web interface is running. Once the web interface is up and running, there you. This is where VLC Direct comes in, and it gets real fancy here, Matt.
Get there upon your app there.
So VLC Direct will automatically scan your network and detect the web interface running on your instance of VLC as long as they're sees on the same running. Network, right?
Okay,
so you don't really have to do much beyond that.
Okay.
Once you've done that, and I'll show you. I'll show you the screenshots. Once you've done that, VLC Direct gives you the option to take any of the media that's on your phone and send it to the VLC instance on your PC.
Oh, that's handy.
Yeah, so if you've just taken some photos or if you just took a video and you want to show it to some folks, if you got hooked up to your TV, you could send it to your computer right away, sort of like AirPlay allows or the Chromecast allows. It also allows you to execute media that's stored locally on the PC and control it from the phone. So I'll give you an example here.
So that really cuts the makes it more seamless between the devices. You don't.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of handy.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't matter if it's on the phone or on the device. Now, it's every now and then for me, it's a little hit and miss. But here, I'll try. So I'm going to send a video that I started. I took out in the backyard. So the first time it comes up, you see I got an error message.
Right.
That just happens sometimes. I don't know why. But if I hit it like again here, let me hit it. There we go. Now it works this time.
Okay.
So there. So now I can play and stop this video here on my Android phone, and I'm sending it to VLC. So now I'm playing it. Oh, see, it's buffering a little bit because probably my wireless.
Sure, we got a lot going on.
Yeah. So I'm sending that. Well, the wireless of my bedroom too.
Oh, yeah.
But so here I can send that. Now if I send like a this is the other trick too is if you're on a weak wireless signal, you just send like a lower resolution video. Like
so you can accommodate if you've got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. Here's a 3 megabyte video. This will probably play just fine.
Okay.
Wait for it and go.
Wait for it.
See though, so now it starts.
Oh, there it is.
And it actually, you can see down in the VLC bar, right when I start it, there'll be a little indication that it's buffering, and you can see that VLC is actually trying to buffer the.
There it goes. It's doing a pretty good job though. You know.
Yeah.
Considering I've how much we got have going on.
Well, I only have 2 bars of Wi-Fi out here because it's up in the other end of my house, but. When you have a little bit better signal, it'll work a little better. It's going to be kind of hit and miss because, like, those are HD videos I'm sending. So, you know.
That's pretty,
But, so now if I go over to the computer icon here, I can now browse the files that are on my computer. I can even browse.
Oh, that's cool.
Check this out. This is crazy. So I have right here my NFS share added to VLC.
Ooh.
So now on my, I can start video files. So here I will start Back to the Future. That's on my NFS server.
Ha!
From my phone.
Oh, that's nice.
And I'm not streaming it from my phone. I can now turn my phone off. I can put it away. It'll keep playing just fine because it's now playing inside VLC.
Man.
So there's no data. If I execute a file that's on the NFS share or on the computer, VLC takes care of that connection.
Oh, here's
the phone's no longer involved.
Hotel room, on a business trip, laptop's open across the room. You're tired. You don't want to get up. You grab your phone. You do everything you need to do from VLC remote.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yep. So there you go.
Good use case.
Back
to the Future.
Yeah, Back to the Future.
Good stuff.
So that's VLC Direct Pro. It does all kinds of neat things. You can send photos. You can send. It can detect all the music on your phone, and you can send music tracks. So it breaks it all out into videos, music, and local computer stuff. So it's really nice.
It's got cool Plex-like capabilities, but I like the fact that it really is less about where the media is stored. Where Plex, it does kind of matter where the media is stored. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So here I'm going to try sending just a photo. See if I can do just a still. See if it'll let me. It kind of hit and miss sometimes. You'll find that at least in my experimentation. Sometimes you just have to. There it goes. So it took me a couple of times to send that.
Right.
But every now and then, like if you tap it a couple of times, it'll show
that's
up on the screen.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it's VLC. You can also get a pro version, and then it removes all the advertising that's in here. There's only one ad that is really along the top there.
And, for that, what the heck, right? I mean, shoot.
Shoot, Matt.
Shoot.
So go check out VLC Direct Pro. We will have it in the show notes. And it's essentially just a really nice way to send media from your device, either it be pictures, music, or videos, to your desktop. And if you have a good Wi-Fi signal, you can do HD. If you have a weaker Wi-Fi signal, you probably need to stay to SD like I was having to do out here in the garage.
But either way, you have playability options, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's what's funny is it doesn't do any local playback. It's VLC, but not as we know it, Matt. Not as we know it.
Okay.
All right.
Still pretty cool.
Moving on to the Linux desktop pick for this week. You're going to have to dig a little bit to find this one for your distribution of choice. I've linked to a couple. I couldn't find one for OpenSUSE or Fedora, but I got you Arch users and Ubuntu users covered.
You know it's going to be there for the Arch.
You
just know, yeah.
It's called MKV Extractor GUI, and there are several different things that are called MKV Extractor. You want MKV Extractor GUI. And what this does is, so the MKV file It's a widely used video container format that's open, mm-hmm. and it allows for multiple things inside an MKV file. So when you have an MKV file, you can have a video track in there. You could have multiple audio tracks, right. you know, sometimes English.
They get the subtitles too, doesn't it?
Oh, tons of sub. You can have all kinds of stuff in there.
So it's a great container. I mean, it's
It is very powerful. And here is MK Viewer, MK Extractor GUI. Now, the problem is every now and then you get one of them MKV files that's got way more, it's got all these subtitles in there, or it's got the wrong default language selected.
Oh, yes, every time.
Yeah. So if I go in here, and so we'll be talking about these later, but these are Blu-rays that I have ripped recently, okay?
Oh, okay. Yeah, from the, we showed you.
Right.
Yeah.
So when I open these up, you can see in here, there is, here's all the chapter information, here's my subtitle track, here's my audio track. Now, I can see in here, because the way I've ripped these, this is an English audio track, but if it was... a German audio track, it would say German right there.
That's so handy. So you're not, it's no longer a guessing game.
Right. You know? And then you could just extract that and you can say, okay, I want this and I want this and I want
this. Cool.
You can also say convert the Dolby digital sound to AC3, which will play back on more devices.
Right.
And then when you execute it, it won't re-encode the file. It will just rewrap those files in a new MKV. It doesn't degrade the quality at all. You don't have to wait for video to re-encode. So you can remove languages from MKV files that you don't speak.
So it's just a new container. It's not new code. Okay, right.
Totally. Yeah. Exactly. It's not new video encoding. It's just a new container.
Good stuff.
And you know, if you've got like an MKV file where the default has the subtitles on and you don't need subtitles on that video, you open up MKV Extractor GUI and you can pull them right out.
What a great way to back up your media. I mean,
yeah, this is also a way if you wanted to create an MKV file and you wanted to store maybe something with that file, video file, you could use MKV Extractor GUI to do that.
Oh, totally. Like if you wanted to do maybe subtitles for a family movie or something like that, that'd be kind of cool.
Yep. So I have links to the AUR version and let's see, I also have links to a... Do I have a link? Yeah, to a PPA for
Nice.
Ubuntu.
So yeah, you got Ubuntu and Arch covered. Those are the two biggest.
I searched around in the OpenSUSE build service and I didn't see anything for
I've run into that with a few apps. It's kind of what pushed me back over to going another direction.
It's so cool because it's just without having to retouch the files means that like you could have a 25 gigabyte MKV file, and you could extract stuff out, and you're not spending 12 hours for it to re-encode.
You're not handbreaking it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you've used it, you understand.
And you're not hurting the quality either.
No. Nice and fast.
Hey, Matt, before we run, I want to remind folks that they can participate and contribute to the show. They can send us picks for Runs Linux for the desktop or Android pick. Love to get some desktop picks that you guys feel like we haven't mentioned that we should have. Like Conky was a great example.
Yeah.
And so send in your suggestions. One great way to do that is to submit them to our subreddit, linuxactionshow.reddit.com.
I'd go so far as to say that's our number one way to get a hold of us. That's really good.
I'm always in there. Even if I'm not responding to every thread because that gets unobtainable, I am at least reading them.
Absolutely. Exactly. Same here. Yeah, sometimes I'll chime in. Sometimes I'll troll back.
Yeah, sometimes like, you know, Chris doesn't respond very often. I'm like, I try to respond several times a day. I apologize.
Exactly.
It's, you know, but we are in there and we're taking the feedback very seriously.
Totally.
We watch that not just for like the obvious things like what people vote on, but I monitor trends and I notice a lot of subtle hints that help influence the show that I don't even think you guys realize. LinuxActionShow.reddit.com. It's funny, we've got people who are trolling in there that don't even watch the show now because it's such a great subreddit.
That's awesome. I love that. Hey, that works.
So go check that out and you can help make the show even better.
Good stuff.
All right, Matt, let's do the news.
Hey, it's the news, and this episode's brought to you by...
Ting.com. Ting is mobile that makes sense, Matt. Let me tell you a little bit about Ting, if I could, sir.
Tell me about Ting.
All right, I'm going to tell you about Ting. Ting's been my mobile service since the beginning of the year. Hallelujah.
You don't say.
Hallelujah. Let me tell you what. Now, how many people come on the air and say, I love my mobile company?
All the time. They're always coming and saying, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me since I went to the dentist.
I think you have it backwards. I think you have it backwards.
They love their. I mean, no, I know they love Ting, but don't. But they're not going to love
loves
their
Ting.
Other.
Yeah, everybody.
But
loves
they're not going to love their other mobile phones.
No, how could they? Because they are not anywhere near as awesome as Ting. Let me tell you a little bit about Ting. No contracts. No early termination fees. No bundling of ride along services.
None of that nonsense.
You just pay for what you use, and bundling of like, oh, I don't know. Let's say something like tethering, hotspot. That's not some add-on charge. That's not some extra package you got to sign up for. You don't got to be a family share plan.
No fancy terminology. Just get her done.
You just turn it on and use it. That's what I love about Ting. Go to last.ting.com. Save $25 on the best mobile service that's out there. Go check out the way their rates work. This is going to blow your mind right here. They break your rates out by minutes, text messages, and megabytes, and they just bill you at the end of the month for whatever bucket you fill into. Mm-hmm. You can plug in, kind of get an idea what you're going to want. Let's say maybe you don't use the phone a lot. Say you get 500 minutes. Maybe you text message a lot. So we'll pop that up to 2,000 messages, and we'll give you 3,000 megabytes of data usage. Mm-hmm. You got one phone on there. There you go. With built-in hotspot tethering, 3 gigabytes, $83 a month. That's way cheaper than you're going to get on anything else out there. You can go over to ting.com and check out their savings calculator. Plug in your current bill and just compare. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Oh,
it is mind-numbing the difference in price you'll pay. You'll see how you're being taken advantage of today and how Ting makes that difference.
Oh, it's a stupid, crazy difference. It'll just blow your mind when you see their data.
And I'll give you another thing I like that Ting's just helping you along the way. Here's my Ting account panel here.
Oh,
and
yes.
I can go into alerts, and I can define a new alert in my control panel. Look at this. Look how easy this is. So when I say when my account exceeds 200 minutes or whatever I want.
Right.
You know, I could say, or if I didn't want minutes, I could say megabytes or maybe messages,
well,
right?
It's all right there. You're not having to hunt and peck for, you know, your options and your settings. You can find it super simple.
I say, if I get more than 100 messages,
yeah.
I mean, holy moly.
Right.
If I get more than 100 messages, send me an email. Let
me
know.
No kidding.
You know, just say, hey, buddy, by the way, you're using a lot. Also, they'll notify you via push message if you have the optional Ting app. That's the other thing I like
I
a lot.
I like that.
They let you manage your Ting service via a mobile app. I'm going to install this sucker right now. Why
no
don't
kidding.
I have this?
I know. It's like,
I had it on my
email,
note, too. I got to put it
you
on
know,
my
you may not see the email, but you're going to see the push.
Oh, you're going to see the. Well, it's also like you're on the go. Maybe you had some friends with you. You're like, hey, I could turn on tethering. Let me just check my usage real quick. And it's no big deal because you only pay for what you use. You don't have to worry about getting into some sort of crazy rate game where they're going to charge you a ton.
Straight
on top of that, if you have any questions, if you get stuck along the way, if maybe you need a little help with your Ting service, not only do they have extremely active forms and some really good help online, you can also call them at 1-855-TING-FTW between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern, and a real live, actual human being empowered to solve your problem answers the phone.
No robots.
Some kind of crazy magic that.
I know. It's like people, no automated nonsense, no robots, human beings. That's a good thing.
I also absolutely love the fact that the way their rate plans work out means that I can have multiple phones on my plan. I only pay a flat $6 a month per phone, so I've got several phones. And I don't have a guilt trip if one phone sits a little unused that month because I didn't need to test anything on it. No big deal. Ting's awesome rate plan means I'm not sitting there paying for something that I'm not using. Go to last.ting, save $25 off your first month or $25 off your first device. Love Ting. Go check them out. And thanks to Ting for sponsoring the Linux Action Show.
Big thanks to those guys. Good
Boom.
Stuff.
All right, Matt.
All right.
Now, I want to tell you a little bit about MailPile.
MailPile.
Kind of sounds,
cool name.
Kind of sounds like
Reminds me of MailSack a little bit.
Yeah,
it kind of does, you know?
MailPile, I love talking about MailSack.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they are launching. MailPile has actually been around. I checked their GitHub page out.
Yeah.
From what I could tell, they've actually maybe been around for as long as 2 years.
Wow.
They've decided recently they want to refactor their code. They want to make it look a lot better. They want to bring some new people online. And honestly, they kind of just make no bones about it. All the revelations around Prism and the NSA has sort of made them refocus and sort of want to double down on the
good
project.
Good for them for, you know, embracing that and making that work.
So MailPile is the goal is to take email back, they say, a modern, fast webmail client with user-friendly encryption and privacy features. It'll be 100% open source. I want to play a little bit of their video, and then we're going to talk about it. I'm excited because this could be a premier open source mail platform. So let's take a listen.
All right.
The free software world really needs better webmail. We need something that can compete with Gmail, compete with Hotmail, and compete with all the other cloud providers, not just on freedom, but on features as well. My name is Bjarni, and I'm an Icelandic free software developer. For the past 2 years, MailPile has been my hobby, a side project I work on in my spare time. This spring, I decided I wanted to make it my full-time job, I wanted to put together a team, and try and make something really cool. To make this happen, I've assembled a team of three. Myself, Brendan Novak, and Smauda McCarthy.
Email's basically one of the things that runs our planet, but everybody's doing it insecurely. When you send an email, what you're doing is you're really sending something that functions more like a postcard than a letter, in the sense that anybody who sees it on its way from or its origin to its destination, can read its entire contents. Even worse than that, anybody who wants to could write a new postcard and claim that it comes from you.
So one of the things that we've talked a lot about is one of the obstacles that solutions like this face are the ease of use of encryption. And one of the things that MailPile is targeting is built-in OpenPGP sort of from the very get-go that's very easy to use, sort of automatically sets up, everybody uses it, and it's going to be an open-source package that relies on standard open-source tools and servers that you can deploy on a cloud-hosted solution, or you could deploy on your own server.
I like that. I like the level of control they're giving folks, and I like the fact that they're addressing it in a way that really matters to people, especially these days.
Now, they got a really good – now, this is all mock-up at this point because they're reworking the UI right now, but they've got a really nice web UI. Now, it's all going to be web-based. Now, I don't know if eventually they plan to have an IMAP interface, but it's initially
– gives them some flexibility to get out the door on multiple platforms fast.
Exactly, and they really are targeting killing Gmail in a big way because one of the things that they realize is the appeal of these web UIs is that – webmails, it's very easy to get up and running. It's very fast. You know, you don't have to worry about installing software, which a lot of users struggle
running
with.
Running on anything.
Yeah. So MailPile is it's on Indiegogo right now. It's at $13,000 in funding. They've got a goal of $100,000.
Got some good 38 days left. I think this is what we saw missing with the mail client that you were excited about is that both great mail clients, but with Gary, that we actually see a very definitive, here's why you really are bent on throwing some money at it, because it's addressing a need.
Right, I mean, now when you look at this, you can kind of see, okay, Gary was, what maybe Gary had missed the mark on was, it wasn't really solving any existing email problems.
Gorgeous client, great tools, really responsive compared to Thunderbird, but it just wasn't really... Yeah. Right. Loud enough, I guess.
Right. Whereas, when you look at the two, like Thunderbird, I actually ended up going back to because of its GPG encryption support when you get add-ons.
So it's clunky, but it works.
When you have something like this, though, that offers good UI, that offers better mobile experience, and also offers built-in support for encryption, maybe those are enough features to sort of tip it over. But
I think possibly.
You know, we're sitting here, and it's only at $13,000.
And I think they're going to really have to get some press attention for this to work. Hopefully, you know, us mentioning it will help. But I think just in general, if this is something that's important to you, throw some money their way.
Yeah, and I mean, I think they're going to continue on depending on how much funding they get, but the more funding they get, the further the project gets.
Yeah.
They're also accepting Bitcoin donations.
So that'll help.
Yeah,
that will help. And it's on target.
I'm excited to see where it goes. I linked to a write-up on it over at ghacks.net. Mm-hmm. They sort of take the, going against Google approach on it. So if that's kind of your thing, that's an interesting article to read as well.
Yeah, it's a good PR spin. I mean, it's the way I would take it if I was them.
Encryption comes in another form as well. The developers will add support for OpenPGP signatures and encryption to the core of MailPile so that it can be used intuitively and without all the hassles usually involved in setting this up properly.
Nice.
I like that goal a lot.
Good problem-solving stuff, yeah.
I feel like there has been some really awesome open-source encryption. It can solve a lot of problems for a lot of folks, but there's just people are not using it because of whatever reason, because it's not set up for them, I guess.
Exactly. I'm not thinking of it. It's probably not a big deal. Meh, you know. But if they have something that's all done for them, then the transition becomes a lot easier.
And I think over time, more and more people are going to become interested in this particular topic. This sort of continuous state of surveillance sort of sets in and people realize the long-term negative aspects of that. Let's talk a little bit about Ubuntu Edge, a little Ubuntu Edge catch-up before we move on. This was an interesting story this week. LastPass, I'm a huge LastPass fan, announced that they will hand out premium plans to those who get an Ubuntu Edge phone if they reach their funding. That's kind of
awesome.
And I guess that also then shows that they'll have a LastPass app.
That's very cool and very helpful.
Yeah. So let's go see how the Ubuntu Edge phone is doing.
See what how close they are to their goals.
The funding has kind of definitely stalled a little bit. I think as of we're recording this episode, they're about 25-ish percent, $8.1 million out of a goal of 32.
And I honestly feel like that they're going to need that push at the end. I don't know who from or how it's going to work. But,
this has been an interesting debate watching this online this week. So a lot of folks are like, campaigns are, they have big kick-ups in the beginning, then they lull, and they have big kick-ups again. And other folks are like, no, they need to have a sustained rate of funding regardless, or they're not going to make it.
Sustained rate of funding doesn't exist, except for maybe games. That's the only time I've ever seen that actually happen. Games and maybe movies, things like that. Things that are really emotional, but with something like this.
I'm surprised. You know, I thought we did a decent job debunking this meme last week, but the HW Killer and a few other folks in the chat room are still saying, well, if it doesn't make it, Mark will fund it. But
Not necessarily.
Yeah, I argue that's not the case. Mm-hmm. First of all, you got to remember that this funding is sort of breaking out around $700, $800 per phone.
Right.
When you're actually manufacturing less devices, that might be too low. They might actually not be charging enough, and then Mark's got to cover that difference.
It's practically subsidized as it is, and on top of the fact that he's using this as a tool, basically a proof of concept to the companies he's pitching, which he has had interest from them, but they do need to see this come to fruition because mm-hmm. this is an indicator as whether or not people will buy it and whether or not these companies want to throw back into it. So if he funds it, he kind of shoots himself in the foot, really.
Right, yeah, because then he's not getting that valuable signal, as he likes to say. Yeah. And Jono was going to join us this week, but his flight was delayed.
Yep.
So we'll probably pick this up next week, which will be probably even more relevant, the conversations we're going to have at that point, because it's going to be even closer.
Sure.
Curious to see where this goes and what it means if it doesn't make it.
Yeah.
And it's really going to be something if they do pull it off.
Oh, it's huge.
At this point, it's really going to be something. It's going to be a big story.
I hope they do. I think it would be healthy to have a little something else on the market.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Matt, well, brace yourself because it's time. That's right, Matt. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's the Wayland. No, I'm sorry. The X11 Death Watch. I was going to say the Wayland Triumph.
It's the mirror. it's the monkey suit Death Watch. That's what I'm hoping.
No. So that is our new jingle, thanks to the chat room, for the X11 Death Watch section of the news. Every now and then, when big things happen on the move to X11 or away from X11, we'll do a little segment on it. So we're going to start with our first story when it comes to the move away from X11. Fedora has announced that they'll be porting GNOME to Wayland.
Boy.
So now we got somebody who says, you know what, guys? We're going to take on the hard work. We're going to do the big task.
That's pretty heavy stuff.
We're going to buckle down. So here it is. I love this. Summary for this on the Fedora wiki. Hmm. Port the GNOME desktop to Wayland.
Clean and simple.
That's
to
the entire summary.
Right? That's a big job. Don't let the summary fool you.
Right, exactly.
Holy cow.
They have it targeted. You ready for this?
Oh.
Fedora 21.
Wow.
That's not too far
away.
Oh,
it's not. No. Really?
Fedora stays at the forefront of Linux development by adopting the next-generation display server technology after X. Wow. Aiming for Fedora 21 with this transition gives us the chance to influence many aspects of the Wayland-based user space before they're set in stone.
Yeah. Good time to get started, I guess, right?
And it's an interesting logic where the Fedora is like, we benefit by being the people that take this on because then we get to set the tone.
Totally.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, moving right along on the move away from X11, Pharonix ran a story this week about a new game. Well, not a new game, but a game that's been ported to Wayland/Weston. You might have heard of it before. It's called Neverball.
I have.
Neverput Games has ported the Neverball game over to Wayland and Weston, as per this tweet. How about that, Matt? So we've
that's
got our first.
That's crazy. That is the first game that I can think of. I mean, so that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not so much which game it is. It's the fact that games and,
definitely not so much which game. But
No, but it's very, very important. It's the first step.
Dun, dun, dun. And moving right along as we continue on the X11 ride, Sailfish has announced they're beginning work on moving Sailfish OS over to Qt 5 and Qt Quick 2 and Wayland.
Holy cow.
Dun, dun, dun,
dun. Good grief. Yeah. It's like all at once, too.
So we have that. And then, which I'm very excited about as a former IT support guy, because this is one of the things that I was concerned about. The Real VNC project has announced plans for remote desktop support on Wayland.
About time. Good stuff.
And this is worth noting just because as of right now, at least according to the Canonical developers, there's no plans for a remote desktop solution for Mir.
So this might help address that in the future.
Well, this is for Wayland.
Yeah,
but yeah, you're right. Maybe what they solve here.
I'm still on the fence with that. I think we will see some Wayland support in Ubuntu at some point. I think it's going to happen.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Not right away, but I think it will.
At the moment, there's no VNC support for Wayland, but there is an RDP backend for use with Microsoft's remote desktop protocol.
Wow. Okay.
Wow.
Wow.
Hopefully, Real VNC's Wayland efforts will come to fruition in the next Wayland Weston update. Wouldn't that be interesting if it was actually integrated in the very backend?
That would be bizarre.
You could just turn it on and you had remote access at that level. All right. So there you go. Let's play it again. Let's play it again.
Dun,
you ready,
dun,
Matt?
Dun. Woo!
Yeah!
Nice.
X11 Death Watch. Watch.
So that's dramatic.
That's crazy.
How about that? So we got links to all that stuff. That was I just feel like we just busted through like four or five really big Wayland stories.
Yeah.
It's coming, Matt. It's coming sooner than later. Pretty soon, I think we'll be having a segment where we're sitting down here and running one of our favorite desktops on.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that will
be. Good stuff.
All right, Matt. That's all the news for this week. One of the things that's plagued Linux users for a long time is managing their Blu-ray collection under Linux. This is something that I just wanted to finally just solve and move on, because as my kids have gotten older, protecting my Blu-ray collection has gotten more and more important, and my regular DVDs as well. This would actually work for DVDs, too.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to talk about the solution that I arrived and really how easy it is actually to get going and set up once you've just got all the parts in place.
Nice.
But first, Matt, I want to thank our segment sponsor, System 76.
Love these guys.
System 76, makers of the finest machines designed to run Linux from the very beginning. And let me tell you, as a Bonobo Extreme owner, every day I am so thankful that I have this laptop. It is so. It has become, as I've had a lot of hardware failures lately, it has become my rock. Everything I move more and more on to
everything
here,
just crashing and burning around you, but really, you know this is going to be here for you.
It is my island of tranquility, and I honestly, too, I was reading through some people who have really struggled with video drivers and problems like that under Arch. I think a big part of the success that I've had running Arch Linux has been that the Bonobo is such a great machine for Linux in general.
Right.
I really have not had challenges with any of that kind of stuff. So there's all kinds of benefits, not just when you're running Ubuntu, but for you Ubuntu users, you really get a complete package. Now, we talk about all the time, they have this brand new Ultrabook. And I see these threads online. People are like, oh, what Ultrabook would be the best one to buy and then install?
All the time.
What Ultrabook should I buy and install Linux on? Are you kidding me?
I want to make sure it has a Windows sticker on it so then I can bitch and complain later when it doesn't work as thought.
This is built to run Linux. Go check out the new Ultra Pro portable laptop from System 76. Man, what a sweet rig. Yep. But if you need a desktop, I really think the secret to the performance price ratio right here is the Rattel Performance. This little box, I've seen this machine.
It snuck in there, didn't it?
It's kind of nice.
Yeah,
it's quiet. It's got a lot of power. It's got a lot of options. You can do some nice integrated GPU. You can do an extended onboard GPU. I really think this is a great machine, and it's a perfect example of the fit and finish of System 76 boxes and why I think they're just fantastic.
Good case size. And I love the little pedestals. You know, it's very living room friendly, too. It'd be a nice little media box.
It would be, wouldn't it? Yeah, it'd actually work really good in the studio, too, I think.
Yeah, I was just looking at it. I was thinking, you know, that actually is quite aesthetic.
You know, if we knew some company that maybe had, like, a spare one of these and they wanted to send it for me, I could use that.
I'm just saying.
Anyways, go check out System76.com. These guys build machines that are born to run Linux, and they build complete solutions from end to end, and they support them for years. It's really, as a Linux user, the exact kind of thing we want to see. We want to see companies like this. They're good, genuine companies making a great product built around Linux. Love System 76. Go get yourself something real nice and tell them the Linux Action Show sent you.
Got a 2008 laptop I got from them. I still get support on it.
I have worked for companies that are no longer in existence that bought me System 76 hardware that I have used from those since that day. I mean, these companies, like, they got this stuff for me, like, I want to say it was like maybe 2008, 2007, and it is still functioning.
I know, isn't that crazy?
It's
like, what?
Like, the company is no longer around, but the hardware is still a champ, and it is it's unbeatable. I absolutely love it. So go check out System 76, you guys.
Good stuff.
All right, Matt. So I wanted to come up with a way to back up Blu-rays with some flexibility. First of all, I am a quality freak. I encode video for a living. Right,
You're very selective as to how your video looks.
I am very particular, you know, and I know how it can look, and I know when it looks bad, and I know what to look for. Mm-hmm. And so, when I'm watching a movie, the problem is, and this is kind of an OCD thing, I guess, is when I'm watching a movie, if I see bad encoding, it actually takes me out of the movie because I realize, oh man, that's encoded wrong.
And you totally lost your soul.
It's distracting. It is. So I have actually just taken to encoding all of my own video myself. That way, I make sure it's done right and it meets my quality standards. And I wanted to be able to do this on my laptop. I wanted to be able to do it on a desktop.
Sure.
I need to be able to move around because I've got a lot of different machines that do different jobs at different times. So I decided, instead of going with anything internal, I went with this LaCie Blu-ray USB 3.0.
Oh, then that's an important differentiator.
Yeah, and it's bus power, too. Now, it is one of these units that's got the two USB adapters on it, so you got to plug one in for the data and one in for the power.
Oh, okay.
But that's okay.
But that's fine. If you're getting a good quality, not stuttery experience,
you can
worthwhile.
Also get a power adapter if you want.
If you wanted to, but who cares, right?
I mean, and this thing has worked. And I was a little nervous about going USB for this.
Right. But I've had good experiences with other optical.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for DVDs and CD-ROMs, it's been fine. So I thought, all right, I'll give it a try with USB 3.0 on Blu-ray. Totally been flawless. Works just fine on my Bonobo here. Which has a USB 3.0 port.
Yeah.
And then the other thing about this is I can take it to other rigs. So I have a machine that's in the studio here that when I'm not doing
that's where
Skype,
the external option really comes in handy. It's like you can run it on whatever you want.
So I went that way. You could totally – this would totally work with internal as well. So I'll plug it in here. And I want it, the reason why I want to show you this, because I think an important part to making this work really well under Linux is I follow a specific order of execution.
Sure.
And when I stick to this order of execution, I generally don't have any problems. When I don't follow this order of execution, sometimes a disk doesn't get read right.
You're going to have a bad time.
Yeah, you could just potentially have a bad time. So first thing I do, obviously, is I hook up the external drive.
Okay. Get all that plugged in.
Yeah. And then once I have the external drive launched,
you're
going
to check and see if it's installed.
It should be. Yeah, you could always definitely worth checking. But then once I have it, one quick way you can find out if your system sees it is launch the program that I this is the secret sauce right here. It's called Make MKV. It's been out for Linux for a little while. Mm-hmm. It is a proprietary program. You can try it for free for 30 days, and it handles the Blu-ray decryption, the AACS, and the BD Plus decryption.
I love that it does it all for you. Remember back in the day, just to get all that to happen, it was like
trying to find the key.
It's just, and the problem is on Blu-ray is that they have a system where they can update that key.
Nice.
So it's
that's
not.
That's handy.
Well, no, what I mean is the Blu-ray encryption can be updated. So if you are manually circumventing the encryption, within several, maybe like 6 months, within about six months, the encryption on the Blu-ray. The encryption on the Blu-ray changes, right?
I understand.
So Make MKV will then issue an update that accommodates for that new encryption standard.
That's important.
Yeah, that's
very important, actually. Okay.
It's kind of nice. So you can go over to Make MKV. It's $50 if you buy it. You can try it for 30 days for free. I bought it.
Yeah.
And what it does is it takes the Blu-ray and it rips the Blu-ray, decrypts it, and puts it into an unencumbered MKV file. It doesn't encode it. It is full size. So I'll show you kind of how that works. So once you have your Blu-ray drive in your system, you have it attached, you'll see in Make MKV, it'll detect all the drives on my system.
Right.
So I could rip a DVD or I could rip a Blu-ray. So I have the Blu-ray drive detected, it gives you little indicators that tells you its status. Like right now in the messages it says no disk inserted. Mm-hmm. If you have a disk in there and you see that, then you know you got a problem.
Sure.
You're going to have a bad time. So then you take out your disk. And I put the disk in there when I have Make MKV running. I think this is an important part. I have found that if I put the disk in and then launch Make MKV, I don't know why.
Sometimes it doesn't.
My subsequent rips don't work as well, or it doesn't see all the tracks. I don't know what it is about that. But so you put it in there. You see it.
Oh, that's a nice little animation.
Yeah. And so Make MKV all along the way should be giving you signals. It should detect when your drive bay is open, and then it should spin the drive. And then when it's done spinning, it should detect if it's a Blu-ray or a DVD. Now, you got to keep in mind where you're going to back these things up to. Okay?
Right, you need a destination. Sure.
Let's see. I've already ripped the Back to the Future. So I will go. So I'll just give you an example here. If I go look on my, I rip everything to my NFS share because it's so large.
Right.
So Back to the Future ripped is 23 gigabytes.
Oh wow. Okay.
So you need to have somewhere you're going to be able to store 23 gigabytes because this is a Blu-ray and it rips the full quality track from the Blu-ray disc.
And I think
not
that's
encoded.
An important differentiator to other applications is that you're not re-encoding squat. You're literally dropping this in a container that your computer can work with. So.
And you see now Make MKV has a little Blu-ray symbol on the disc and the drive.
I love that animation. It just really helps you to kind of visualize what's going on without wondering.
Once it's, and if it was a DVD, it would have a DVD image in there, right?
Right, sure.
So once it's detected it, you click on that, and now Make MKV will scan all of the tracks on the disc. If it's a TV series, like I have Star Trek here.
Oh,
and
that's so cool.
Star Trek series will have several titles on the disc. Each title is one of the episodes. So you kind of have to – it's a little tricky under Linux. But you see, when I'm looking at these titles, you see how this one's 29 gigabytes? This title one here is 29 gigs.
Oh, yes, right. And it's not – it's you have titles and chapters. And
right.
So that gets – okay.
And so these titles, 1 gigabyte, 200 megabytes, 3 gigabytes.
These
are all likely like special features or like title animations. I don't need those, so I'll just uncheck those. Now, you could back those up as well if you wanted to, right?
Well, another thing I'm noticing, too, is that if it doesn't have the word chapters or chapter in there somewhere, it's probably just fluff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a fast way of doing.
So then you choose where you want it to rip to. Make sure that's the spot that you have a lot of storage.
Right.
You give it the name, and then you click this Make MKV file, and it'll take about, you know, in my setup here, it took about 45 minutes to copy off.
Pretty reasonable.
That's really actually quite reasonable.
Coming off optical, that's actually amazing.
And now if this was a TV series on here like the Star Trek one, you would have multiple titles.
Right.
Because you have multiple episodes on one disc. Since this is a movie, there's really only one title that I want to back up.
I see. Okay.
All right. So then I would just click Make MKV, and it would start the process. And I'd show it to you, but I've already done that, and we don't have 50 minutes to
spare. Oh, no, no. Just sitting here through that would be a little painful.
So as I mentioned earlier, once the file has been ripped, you have this MKV file that is huge, huge. And if it's a DVD, it's going to be about 4 gigs or so. Mm-hmm. And you could call it good at this point. It'll actually play.
Oh, you just VLC it.
Will play a lot. Plex will play it.
All right.
A lot of things will play it at this point.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
And there's different programs you can analyze this with. We talked about earlier. You could open this up in MKV Extractor,
right.
And you could pull out just the audio track if you wanted
that
to.
Would
or something
be kind of
like
cool because then you can kind of mix and match what you want. Sure.
Yeah, I want to talk about Handbrake. This is where you need to go next. If you want to now take this 29 gigabyte file and make it something manageable, make it something that plays back on a mobile device, something like that, Handbrake's the way you go. Handbrake is gone from a great tool to a serious professional tool, in my opinion. I now use it to encode the video for the Linux Action Show for all our shows.
Oh, okay.
Handbrake is the go-to. You see, if you look right here, I have a little Last 720.
Oh, right.
I click that, and all of my presets for the Linux Action Show file are done. My bit rate, my quality settings, everything is pre-done, and they have a bunch of presets that come built in, so you just pick the device. The one I generally target is Apple TV 3.
Yep.
The reason I do that is it has a really good default mix of quality to speed. This in Handbrake, there's this little slider right here for constant quality, and right now it says RF20. This is sort of like the warp scale. If I turn this down to like 15 or 16... Mm-hmm. I'll take this encoding from a 2-hour encoding to a 7-hour encoding. If I brought this all the way up to like an RF7 or 6, this could be a 2-day encoding process.
So really that slider's how much depends on how much time you want.
It's logarithmic, as they say. Logarithmic. And I never have really, and I really pay close attention, I really don't see much benefit beyond RF20.
Well, and that's the set that, you know, talking about the presets, that's the preset I use on almost everything I have. Just because it really
Apple TV3 is a good one. And you can see when you go in here, this is something to pay attention to if you've got a disc that has multiple different languages. Mm-hmm. This is where you can double check which audio tracks you're going to use. Something Handbrake does really commonly is it takes the AC3 track, which is the raw audio included with the Blu-ray, which is maybe multi-channel. Mm-hmm. It includes that on one channel, and then it also includes just a stereo mix AAC on another channel. So that way your simpler devices will play that, and your more sophisticated devices will play the 5.1 Dolby mix.
That's handy.
Yeah, it's really nice the way it does that. It'll also include subtitles. I usually strip all those out.
Sure.
And then under advanced, if your Blu-ray has them, which it should if you're ripping it yourself, it also will include all of the chapter markers from the disc in the file. And then if your player supports chapters, you can jump around in the file. You can also tag it. So if you want to add in the tags here, so that way if you have something like Plex, it might have a better chance of recognizing it.
Media discovery becomes a whole lot simpler.
Yeah. So you run that, and one of the nice things, too, is you can do a queue. So, for example, if I had a lot. So here you can see I have all of these Star Trek TOS
because
groups,
these
right?
were already ripped sitting on a drive somewhere. Yeah. You can actually, you know, it's not like you're swapping out optical discs.
So instead I went through and I just spent one night and I just sat there and copied, you know, using Make MKV file after file after file after file from my Blu-ray because my son's really getting into Star Trek and I don't want him to damage my $100 Star Trek collection.
Yeah, these
right?
are the original puppies here. Yeah.
Right. And those were gifts from family on top of that. So in Handbrake, you just simply add to queue, and then you could sit here and you can pop in. So if I say source, I can pop in another file. And if I want to use all of the same exact previous settings, the same bit rate, and which you would if you're doing a series,
you
just hit pop add to queue, and you can sit here and keep adding to queue. It'll inherit all of the previous settings, and then you just walk away and let it encode for hours.
So you
want to
do TNG season 3, bam, put it in a queue, go to bed,
right?
Let it do
exactly.
its work. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Yeah. And then I came back the next day, and I had it encoded. Now, to give you an example, so here we have Back to the Future right from the Blu-ray, 23 gigabytes, right? Now, my high quality, very high quality, which is probably beyond what you'd want to use yourself because you don't need to. You don't need to use this high. After I've encoded it, it's at 10 gigs, so I've cut it more than half.
And that's quite substantial because, that's still really
and
high.
It is. 10 gigs is still very high, but I've played it back.
Which is awesome.
And I then I look at that, and I know I don't see any quality difference between the Blu-ray and this encoded version. I've played them side by side, and I can see no difference because X264 is amazing.
So it's like being able to custom roll your own media experience depending on what you expect
on
from
your preference,
media.
Right?
Yeah, on your preferences, totally.
And I figure I want to go with things like the Back to the Future trilogy or Star Trek. I would love if what I encode stands up to a 4K display down the road.
Yeah, right.
Maybe it can't happen, but I want to give it my best shot.
That would be great.
So you combine Make MKV with Handbrake and things like MKV Extractor, another tool to sort of snoop around your files and see what you can get from them, like what audio tracks they are. Like if you want, sometimes you might have a media file that's using MP3 audio or Vorbis audio. You don't know what it's using. Use the program. I've mentioned it before on the show. We made it an app pick a long time ago. Yeah. Media Info, a great app that's available for multiple platforms. Oh, that's the other thing. Make MKV is available for Mac and Windows too.
Oh, that's handy.
And then you combine that with Media Info, which will analyze files for you. And, I mean, this is a really handy app, so you can kind of, like, if something's not playing back on a device of yours, if you've ripped something and it's getting, you might find that when you're playing with Handbrake, certain devices, after you've ripped it, will have kind of crappy playback or have tearing.
Yep.
You can fire up that file into Media Info, look at all of the information, encode another version. Start with smaller files. Don't go right into a big, long Blu-ray. Start with like a 30-minute video. Try multiple encodings of them. Then look all of them in Media Info. Find the one that works by looking at the details in Media Info and then set your encodings around that. You can also use Media Info if there's a video file out there that you've noticed, man, there's a lot of motion or a lot of lights, but it still looks really good. What did they do to encode this video? You can take any video file you want. You drop it into Media Info. You can get the bit rate, the aspect ratio, the audio codec, the audio bitrate, the all the info, and then you can just set up your Handbrake to emulate those settings.
So let's say you found a Kickstarter-funded movie that you really love how the playback, it's just everything flows great, and you're like, I want that.
If you can, you have to get to the original video file.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get that, you've got
it. There you go, and you can just emulate that. That's great.
Media Info is one of those, in fact, I don't even know. Let me see if I have it installed, because if I don't. Media Info. I got to get it if I don't, because I love Media Info. And you can, the fact that you can, look, it's 1.75 megabytes.
That's, that's nothing.
Yeah. All right, so now that I have it installed, let's see if I can run it. Media Info, and I'll give you a little demo of it, because I know I've talked about it before on the show, but I really love it. Oh, that's the command line version. Oh, yeah, so there's a command line version, too.
Oh, sweet.
And there is a command line version of that MKV extractor GUI.
Mm-hmm.
As the name implies, there's also an MKV extractor command line.
That's the importance of knowing the GUI.
There's also a Handbrake command line.
Yeah, I knew about that, which is very cool.
And there's commands for make MKV on the command line. So you see where I'm getting? You could actually bash all of this.
This is true.
Mine is very manual process because I have found that works the
best.
Now
imagine that. You bash the whole thing. You could start bashing multiple. Wow. Oh,
you can have like
totally
put the disk in there. You fire off a shell script.
Your family doesn't see you for a weekend because you're just ripping stuff all weekend long on this bash, right?
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
So there you go. This has sort of been my solution for taking the Blu-rays that have become popular in my family and sort of protecting them, backing them up.
Protect your investment.
Yeah, exactly. And things like Make MKV and a portable – I've gone with the portable Blu-ray drive because I can put it on different machines. That's made it real nice.
And personally, I think that's the better way to go simply because you're not taking a performance hit and you have mobility that you would not have with an internal drive.
Chatroom points out, as you would expect, the GUI version of Media Info is Media Info-GUI.
Oh, that's important.
Yeah, okay. That would make sense, right? So if I – here, I'll do a quick little demo of it. I love that. What's that slide-down terminal called?
Oh, yeah. Wake or Quake or something.
Yeah, you wake?
Yeah, I have that on my system, and I just swear by it. Between that and the launchers.
So let's open a file, and then let's go look at my Back to the Future encoding. Let's go find that.
Yeah, there it is.
So we'll do by modified here. Encoded. Actually, this is a different directory. This isn't where I ended up, but I'll show you. Here's TechSnap, last week's TechSnap.
Oh, okay.
So I opened up last week. So say you watch an episode of TechSnap and you're like, damn, I can't believe how good that looked. That Chris, he's so impressive.
What's he doing?
I want to encode my videos just like he does. You can see here that the overall bitrate of episode 121 of TechSnap was 865 kilobits. You can see that I used AAC audio. You can see the video resolution here. You can see the frame rate. You can see the codec that I used, the version of that codec.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think if you, there's even like a different view mode where you can even get like.
This is where you get the meat and potatoes.
Yeah, here's my encoder
settings. Oh, see, right there. Command line, bam, drop, splap.
This is the actual FFmpeg parameters that were used by Handbrake when this was encoded.
That's going to set you up with a sweet bash setup.
So if you see, so you can really, you know, you can really get in there and, okay, this is what I need to do to make it look right. And then you can go translate that to
I mean, you talk about consistent. I mean, it's
There it is.
Yeah. So that's media info, and then you combine all these tools together, and you can get your favorite content backed up and protected. And then one last bit, and then we'll roll on, because the problem is once you have all of this stuff, you now need to organize all of this stuff.
Right, it becomes a management headache.
Sure. And we've talked about this before, but there's a program out there called Sickbeard. Now, Sickbeard will enable you to pirate as well if you want to. But what you can actually use Sickbeard for is just content management. I have pointed it at a directory, and then I do manual processing. And then as I rip these DVDs, you see how it says downloaded unknown?
Oh, that's because it's ripped. Right.
Yeah, I rip them myself, so it doesn't know where it downloaded them from. But so what I do is I point Sickbeard at my DVD rip directory. And then Sickbeard will go through and say, okay, this is Star Trek Season 3, Episode 13, A Land of Taurus, or the Empath, or the Wink of an Eye. And it will then move them. So then I'll show you what that looks
and
like.
And does Wanted also work with local media? So if you get a new DVD set, you rip it, it says, oh, it's no longer Wanted.
Exactly.
Oh, that's really handy. So Sickbeard has a real nice local aspect.
I know what I've ripped and what I haven't ripped. I could use this. If I wanted to turn to the dark side, I could turn this around and point it at Usenet and go grab those things. But I want to rip them myself.
Right.
Once I have them ripped, Sickbeard will move them from my DVD ripped encoded folder after I ran them through Handbrake. It'll move them from that folder into my Star Trek folder.
Oh, that's handy.
And you see, in my Star Trek folder, I haven't set up any of this folder structure. From this point on, Sickbeard is managing all of this for me. And now if I go into Star Trek, you can see it took the files and if...
it ordered them up,
Yeah, so let's go back and look. So here's the ripped files. Uh-huh. So here's how I named them.
It changes the naming scheme instantly.
And it went through and reorganized them and named them by season and episode format.
That's much tidier. Right? So it actually cleans them up in a really nice way.
Yeah, much nicer. So you could, you could say, all right, I'm good with that. Or you could then have Sickbeard integrate in with Plex.
Right.
So then Sickbeard tells Plex, hey, by the way, there's now these Star Trek episodes available on the server. Mm-hmm. And so when I go look on Plex, here's the episodes that I've ripped that now Plex knows about. So after I've ripped them from Handbrake, after I've ripped them with MakeMKV, sent them through Handbrake for encoding, I no longer touch them.
That's great.
Sickbeard and Plex manage all of the organization for me from
that point forward. Isn't automation awesome like that? And because what a time saver that becomes. Yeah. Now you can spend your time doing important things like getting more Blu-rays to rip.
That's exactly right.
That's the way I see it.
Well, and then I don't have to worry about, like, is this the right episode?
Right.
Is this the right name? No.
It'll sort it.
It manages all of that for me and makes it just... Yeah. Makes the media just easier to enjoy.
I love that.
A lot of tools we just threw at your face, and all of those have been, Plex has been covered in Sickbeard. We've covered those in previous episodes. So if any of those are new to you, just go watch the back catalog of Linux Action Show, and we go into more details on how to set those up in previous episodes.
And we got everything in the show notes for you for those episodes as well.
Boom. All right, Matt, that's the Linux Action Show's look at backing up your Blu-rays.
Back it up.
It's time for Slash Etsy, and this segment is brought to you by Untangle. That's right, firewalls that bring the power of Linux with a very easy-to-use, nice web UI that really almost anyone can use. Untangle firewalls work flawlessly once you have them installed, so you can almost just set them and forget them. They have superior content filtering capabilities. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you guys, when you're picking an edge-of-network device, you really need to think long and hard about something that's going to be supported. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely critical, and something that runs on technology you can trust. That's where Untangle comes in. So go to untangle.com/las. These guys have a free ISO you can download. You can throw the Untangle software on your own rig, see how you like it, kick the tires, see if it does what you want, be impressed by that UI, and then play with turning on different services to really see how great it can be to manage your network properly, all backed by Untangle. Go to untangle.com/las and check out what they have to offer. And if you use the code LAST20 when you check out, you'll save 20%. Off an Untangle subscription. And let me tell you guys, these subscriptions, these things are serious. They have one of the most competitive content filters out there if you've got that as a need. They've got a fantastic spyware and malware filter if you have Windows boxes on your LAN. And they've got great quality of service and VPN options as well that'll make managing remote users totally a snap. Untangle.com/last. Thanks to Untangle for sponsoring /Etsy.
Big thank you.
So I recently was inspired to replace the router firmware on my TP-Link wireless AP. I have no need for my cute, quaint little toy wireless device that runs Fisher-Price processors to actually be a firewall for my network.
Sure.
It's adorable that some people do that, and I appreciate that maybe you don't do anything for real or serious on your network, but if you do, you quickly run into limitations with the stock firmware that's on these devices. And on top of that, with all of the recent NSA revelations and... Heck, there was just a story this weekend about services that can be turned on these devices using the built-in firmware. In fact, check this out. Extraneous network services leave home routers unsecure. This is an article that was on Slashdot. Today's home routers include multitude of extra functionalities, such as the ability to act as a file and print server. An article on CNET shows how an attacker can use vulnerabilities in these services, such as buffer overflows, directory transversal, race conditions, command injections, and bad permissions to take over a router from the local network without ever knowing the administrative passwords.
Oh, that's scary.
Now, when you combine this with the well-documented and well-exploited universal plug-and-play flaws that many routers have, and in the past, Cisco devices, we've talked about this on the TechNet program, Cisco devices have actually gotten remote updates from Cisco to turn on tracking features.
No
permission from the user at all.
Most uncool.
And you always have to wonder when you have a firmware like this that isn't getting updated properly, that does have remote root access. Maybe it's just time to replace that on security grounds as well. But I think you could make the argument for functionality might be worth it too.
Either way.
There's several out there. I mean, there's OpenWRT, there's Tomato. There's a lot of really good ones
out there.
The one I decided to go with was DD-WRT. You can find it at DD-WRT.com. We talked about it a long time ago on the show, and it is fantastic. You go over there, you have a router database, you plug in your router information, it'll tell you if it's supported, and if it is, it'll give you a firmware link. Now, I'm using the good old TP-Link WR1043ND. How about that?
Woo, that's a lot of letters.
That's catchy.
Catchy.
I like it because it's got a decent processor, and it's got removable antennae.
That helps.
Yeah.
Especially if one breaks.
And the TP-Link firmware is actually pretty good comparatively to other ones, but it's, you know, getting a little long in the tooth. Mm-hmm. And the functionality isn't so awesome. And I love me data. I love getting me stats. I love getting bar graphs. I love having...
data porn.
Yeah.
Totally.
Exactly. And so I loaded... it's so great. So to flash a lot of these routers... Mm-hmm. I recommend you use a wired connection.
Always use a wired when you're flashing anything with firmware. That's just my personal opinion.
Good call, Matt. Good call. Yeah. So I recommend the wired connection, and then you just go to the firmware update page. You upload the DDWRT firmware. There's a specific one if you're flashing from factory.
So you really need to pay attention to what you're
doing. Yeah, and I'll link a guide, but this part kind of varies depending on your router. So I can't give you a one-all catch-all guide. You upload this firmware to your router. It goes through a regular firmware upgrade process, like the router thinks it's upgrading to a stock firmware.
Oh, okay.
Reboots the router, Bob's your uncle. When it comes back up, you're running DDWRT.
Oh, nice.
So here's my DDWRT. And just on the very front page, you get a little data porn right there. I get CPU usage, memory, what services are running. Mm-hmm. If I scroll down, I can see what wireless clients and their relative signal that they have.
That's nice.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
You know, this will work as a router, too, if you want. I don't know. I don't know if this thing has, the cojones.
Yeah.
I've set up my wireless. Depending on your device, if you've got, like, a link, there's some Linksys routers that have multiple antennas. Mm-hmm. So you can have multiple wireless. You can have an N-only and a G-only.
And I love that feature.
It lets you do all kinds of nice stuff. DDWRT is my go-to solution when I want to do an extended wireless network, too. So if you've got a house or a building that you need to have uniform coverage, you can get what I would recommend is two of the same model routers. You load DDWRT on both of them. It's very easy to link them up and extend.
And they're basically repeating the signal.
Yeah. It's very easy. Let's take a look over here at status, because this is where you can see some more fun stuff. Remember, I like the data part, right? You get my router name, the model. You can see it's a TP-Link right there with a version of DDWRT.
That's so cool.
There's the Linux 3.5.7 kernel.
That's
love that.
Serious data.
You can see this here. Now, there's a few other things that are very nice from like a wireless management standpoint. If you're having signal problems, you can go to the wireless tab in DDWRT and tell me what other consumer grade router is going to be able to do this. You hit site survey, and the wireless AP actually will do a survey of all the other APs. Now, you can get software to do this, but this is built into the firmware.
Yeah, that's...
So I can see that look at this. All of my neighbors are jamming up here on channel 6. Look at all these guys on channel 6.
Yep.
So now I know, don't set my wireless to channel 6 because all of my neighbors are on channel 6. And if you're having one of these problems where your connection just keeps dropping in and out even though you've got decent signal, this might be what's going on.
Wireless noise.
And you see this button right here where it says join site?
Yeah.
This is where that wireless extender comes in.
Oh, so right.
If
one of
my other APs,
that's nice.
You just click join.
Oh, that's so simple.
Yeah, it's very. You got to have a couple other things defined, but it's very simple. I can see frequencies. I can see their signal strength. All of this stuff. I can see
stuff
if they're encrypted.
Matters.
Here's an open one for some reason. Don't know.
Well,
why
you know,
open.
You need to go and do some
Looks like maybe my Roku device has wireless on for some reason.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, I guess. So that's a very nice feature built in. And then you also have other things like you can get real-time bandwidth charts. So if you've got people on your wireless, you can run these charts to see like the different signal. Or if you're copying files, you want to watch it, you can all of that.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, so
this really just full featured crazy.
Oh, it is so great, Matt. And the great part is that it takes a firmware that was sort of collecting dust on my router and brings totally new functionality and new life into it. And this was updated as of like a month ago. This firmware is pretty current, right?
Right. And versus that ancient dated stuff you had before.
Yeah, yeah. So there are tons and tons of reasons to use DDWRT, including NAT and quality of service. One of the things I think I might play with on our wireless network is we use, in some instances, some network screen capture software.
Yeah.
That works over wireless, but if someone else in the house decides they want to stream Netflix,
right, totally drains away.
And if you're doing a show live, like I can't get up and go like, hey, go turn off Netflix. Hey, I'm doing a show down here.
Exactly. You're screwed.
Yeah.
You're screwed.
So doing something like quality of service will just say, give preference to the wireless screencasting traffic. So there's a lot of things you can play with in here.
Nice.
DDWRT. It's an open source firmware that you can replace on your stock router. They got a compatibility database. You can go check them out. There's also lots of other good ones. So if you guys have played around with another replacement firmware that you love, let us know about it in the feedback thread in the subreddit for this episode. Maybe we'll play with that in a future /Etsy.
That would be cool.
All right, guys,
checking this out when I get home.
Go out there and flash your router. And that brings us to the end of this week's broadcast. But, Matt, before we get out of here, I thought maybe we'd cover a little feedback. What do you say? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. I saw a thread that was started by in our subreddit, and it's called the Ubuntu Sweepstakes. Matt, that's right. The Ubuntu Sweepstakes have been announced in our subreddit, where everybody tries to guess what the final funding amount of Ubuntu's Edge Indiegogo campaign will be. Yeah, okay. So there you go. Started this thread over there. And he's trying to guess how much money in the Ubuntu Edge Indiegogo. Now, he says, here's the rules. You're not allowed to duplicate guesses. You can only submit a guess $1 or higher than the lower than someone else's guess. So you got to read the thread. Entries are allowed until the 8th of August.
Okay.
Last-minute contributions from wealthy individuals, even those who happen to be directly related to Canonical, do count.
Oh.
The judge's decision is final. And there is no prize except for the joy of victory. However, I say we change that last part.
Bitcoin pool. Seriously.
Bitcoin pool. Okay, now you're crazy.
Yeah, because that's it's like gambling, shmambling. Who cares?
There are some Bitcoin betting sites for kind of thing. I was thinking we'll give away a Steam game to the winner.
There you go.
So whoever gets closest to the price within a dollar, we'll do standard game show rules, Price is Right rules.
Right.
So if you go over, how does that work exactly? Because we all know what the fixed. Anyways. You got to guess what you think the final funding is going to be at.
Yep.
And you can't go over. So I guess.
Seems reasonable.
It's only assuming it doesn't reach $32 million.
I don't think it's going to go. If it does go over, it's going to be by a sliver.
Chatroom's already guessing. Look at Chatroom's like, I got this.
$40 million.
No, you guys, you got to go over to the thread and submit it there because that's where we'll go to tally everybody up. We'll have that linked in the feedback section.
Gotta be
in
the subreddit.
And then we'll give away a copy of a new Steam game, a fresh new Steam game to the winner. All right, I wanted to follow up on Aussie Roy's thread because I thought it'd be a good chance for you and I to talk about it. He says he failed the Arch challenge.
Mm.
He's just kind of reached the point where it was just, he's been in computers for years. Back to 1983 is when he was really getting into stuff.
And I like the fact that he really gave some background on his experiences. Yeah. That was good.
Yeah, and he just kind of, to him, he felt like he had some challenge installations with the installation. He got past that. Hit some other road bumps and just kind of burned out and said, it hasn't really been worth it to him.
Right.
And he's wondering, like, what's the trade-off? Like, is it worth all this time investment? And I'm just kind of curious. I thought we'd update you and I.
Yeah.
Are you still running Arch?
I have. So here's the thing, and I'm going to get flamed for this.
No, it's all right.
I'll be honest. I do have Arch on a separate partition, and it's fine. The only thing I ever do with it is I update it. I don't really use it. I have Manjaro on another partition, same computer. And I keep the – because my goal when I first did this is I really heard about all the negative about the
derivatives.
Yeah. And so I was like, all right, so I'm going to try this out and really try and keep – I mean, I know they use separate repos. Arch is always newer. I know all the history. I'm not new to this. I get it. So, what's interesting is they're both intact. They both work really well.
Yeah.
What I found is I began to notice that the whole reason why I was using Arch really was because I like the Arch user repositories. The rest of it, yeah, I don't care. So I found myself using Manjaro more just because it really felt pretty seamless for my experience.
Yeah.
Arch had a little bit newer stuff, but other than that, I think
that's an interesting
aspect. I run a 3.10 kernel.
I think the biggest problem that a lot of people have is that Arch setup is so, it's like this massive task for them. Yeah. I think Manjaro sort of makes that easier. I think it's interesting that you've been running it for a while without issue.
Well, and I wanted to run it not as, Arch was hard and I stopped using it and I used it in Manjaro. No. I want to run both so that I can really get the meat and potatoes of both experiences and understand those differences. And there are some different, very big differences. Manjaro is not Arch. It is based on Arch.
I think I figured out
that's an important differentiator.
I think maybe where the core, why people don't like the derivatives comes from is Arch's secret sauce is that whole keep it simple mentality where...
You're taking responsibility for your desktop, really.
Right? That's
right?
Really, and the meat and potatoes of it.
And everything's filed down to total minimal. Mm-hmm. The other day, I realized I don't have a network manager installed. I meant to install that. Yeah, I never got around to it.
You may not even need it. I mean, depending on what you're doing, you may not think about it.
This is why things don't break as much, because if you just only have what you need, and so because it's simpler, I've been running this now.
You have less moving parts to have break in an Arch install, which can be a real benefit.
And I think Manjaro and Antegros and those other ones. Yeah. Sort of add a little more complexity that adds
They can and do. I tested out a couple of the other derivatives. I didn't really care for them so much. I came back to Manjaro simply because of the way that they – I love the fact that the kernel updates are completely separate from the rest of it.
I like getting my kernel updates from Arch because I feel like I get of course, you got 3.10.
I got 3.10.
And
here's what's cool. I needed for some testing purposes, I needed to roll back to a legacy kernel. I could do that easily and have – I had 3.10 and 3.4 or something like that on there. Just real variety of stuff going on. It was kind of fun to play with that. If you want to try something different, you want to try another distro. I won't say like Arch. You want to try another distro, Manjaro is fun. It's cool. If you're a happy Arch user, you're probably not going to like it because you are using Arch because you want that roll your own experience.
Yeah.
And I'd say stick with that. But,
I find the longer I run Arch, the harder the idea of moving away from it becomes because of the Arch user repo, but also just that I really like getting the latest software. I'm all about I have the most stable release, the current stable release of every
Dropbox is everything. My big one. Yeah, when you go to the Arch user repository, but I'm getting that Manjaro too. You can run yogurt.
Yeah, Manjaro. If I had to reload and I needed to do it in a couple of hours or something, Manjaro might be the way I go.
It's interesting.
I don't know. I might try it sometime.
The big downside I see to Manjaro is that if you're an Arch user, you are getting bleeding edge stuff not just in the Arch user repositories, but also in the Arch repositories proper. You're actually getting that latest stuff. Manjaro stuff's usually about a month old, maybe a little older, maybe a little newer. Depends if you're using stable or unstable. There's a little more flexibility there.
Okay.
And some people aren't okay with that. And you're certainly not going to be taking control of your desktop with Manjaro. That's not a roll-your-own solution by any stretch.
You're not building it from the ground up.
No. If you want to really understand how Linux works, I recommend having an Arch
partition. I think it was well stated in the subreddit that, Arch is a hobbyist distro. And then there's different cars. There's build your own car kits. And then there's car kits that are pre-assembled and you just kind of add on a few parts yourself. And then you go out and buy a completely pre-made car. And I think that's really what it comes down to. And of course, then you can get to Gen 2 and Linux from scratch. And that analogy goes even further.
I think for scratch distros, I say Arch would be my go-to place just because they've really refined it in a way that works well. As long as you follow the instructions, it's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah.
It's something I would encourage everybody to try either in preferably on a separate partition. I don't like it so much in VirtualBox, but try it on a partition, run it, see if you like it, play with it, toy around with it. I enjoyed it.
Pedro writes in via bit message. He says, "Hi, Chris and Matt. I just watched your Linux drive recovery episode, and I've been thinking for a long time about finding a storage solution for my data. Mm-hmm. I'm a musician, and I have approximately 1.5 terabytes of video files from my lessons and concerts, all duplicated across 3 drives. I've had one of those die on me a couple of months ago, and I'm scared to lose data. Right. Also, the system doesn't scale well at all. My drives are almost full, and soon I'll have to buy 2 external 1 terabyte drives or more. I'm considering one of the 4-bay hard drive enclosures that have RAID without needing to connect to a computer. I was looking at this one, and it includes a MediaSonic store link to a MediaSonic ProBox 4.
Okay.
I was wondering how well these would work with Linux, specifically with Linux file systems like Extended 4 or ButterFS. Do you know if something like this will recognize the drives if they are in that format or RAID drives format in a different file system? Any recommendations would be appreciated." So he's dealing with, I think, a problem that more and more folks are dealing with where we have a lot more to store And Linux is not awesome compared to like the BSDs at this.
No, this is something.
I want to talk about more this week. So here's the four box. You see that guy right there?
Oh, that's pretty.
That's Nash. I like it. It's shiny.
Oh,
got some weight to it.
So this was bought by an audience member for the Linux Action Show. I have the 8-drive bay version of that right here next to me.
Oh, yeah.
Mine, however, is not working because I believe my controller does not support multiplexing.
Oh.
Now, he's looking at a different, slightly different unit. His unit...
slightly different shape. Slightly
well, his
different
is only 4 drives for one.
Oh, okay.
Now, this one does not do RAID. I don't think. He wants doesn't one like that it. You put the drives in there, and mm-hmm. it has a RAID controller built into the unit.
Oh, right, right. So what, would that be hardware RAID? Yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually a great way to go. And then mm-hmm. he was asking about formatting. That will just show up to Linux as one drive. So if you put four drives in there, and then you do RAID in this unit, and the way these Pro Box work is you'll just have a little selector along mm-hmm. the top, and you'll get a little LED light, and you'll say, I want RAID 5, I want RAID whatever, and you choose that on there, and then it will do the RAID internally, and then you will attach it to your Linux box, and you will format it with any file system you want.
That's kind of cool. I like that.
Yeah, so that's one solution, and I think...
Probably, for someone like me who is RAID ignorant, I'd probably go that direction.
Yeah, that is really nice to just have that, because then you don't have to worry about setting up RAID on your computer. I also prefer hardware RAID, just to be honest. I know a lot of you guys out there support Linux software RAID. I'm a hardware RAID guy if I can.
KISS principle.
Or I like to use ZFS. Now, this is an area where I feel like I'm going to talk about more. I didn't get a chance to go into the storage stuff. All the drives are here.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in the array,
good
but my controller apparently is not working. So we'll do a segment next week about using ZFS and attaching all of these drives. So you might get more of an answer next week, but you're going in the right direction. And it is a challenge.
So it sounds like, as you said, he's going in the right direction and to definitely tune in for next week so that he can actually learn further.
Assuming I get the storage work.
Assuming.
So Spazzy C writes in. He says, hello, Chris and Matt. At the company I work at, we have an internet server running Microsoft Windows Server 2003 R2. What I didn't know until recently was it is not running IIS, but using XAMPP, which is a Apache, MySQL, mm-hmm. PHP, all bundled up in one.
Sure.
Given the age of the build, by the way, he says they brought in outside contractors, and they just ripped through the server. An old Windows box with an old XAMPP installation. So now they've got to replace it. And so they said, given the age of the build, we're just thinking whole new server. After looking at XAMPP and seeing that it's Apache with a lot of stuff turned on, we want to cut down the attack area and deploy Linux with only the web components as necessary. Our user base is about 3,000 users with only a tiny fraction ever accessing the internet at the same time. Mm-hmm. The old server only had about 10% utilization. We'll be deploying this in a VMware 5 environment. As we are a complete Windows shop, now here's the key part.
Oh, yes.
Which distro would you recommend we implement to get our toes wet in the Linux gene pool? I've listened to a lot of the conversations you've had with Alan from TechSnap as well, so would you recommend deploying Nginx or FreeBSD? Mm-hmm. Thanks for musings you send my way, Spazzy C.
Well, he's a blank slate, so it really provides a lot of options because he doesn't have a defined loyalty to one thing or another.
I think the fact that they're a Windows shop is big. A
mm-hmm.
Couple of reasons. One is they might end up having to rely on outside contractors from time to time when they need stuff done. So they need to go with something that outside contractors are going to have familiarity with. That way they get a good contractor mm-hmm. and they get the best bang for their buck.
Sure.
So I think that limits them right there to 3 distros, SUSE Enterprise Linux, CentOS, or Ubuntu long-term support.
Wow.
Right? And I think when you look at it this way...
I didn't expect to hear Ubuntu in there, but I guess that makes sense.
I would take CentOS off the list myself.
Yeah. really?
Yeah. I just don't like CentOS.
It's just not happening.
No offense to you guys, but I just don't like CentOS. So I would take CentOS off the list. I would probably focus on either... OpenSUSE Enterprise Server or Ubuntu long-term support. And I would probably, since you are a Windows shop, I would probably refine that one notch further and say you probably want to look at Ubuntu long-term support. If you install a piece of software called TaskCell, TaskSEL,
mm-hmm.
then you just simply do TaskCell install lamp-server on Ubuntu. There's a command. I'll have the command linked right here in the show notes.
Right.
TaskCell. So you're saying task select install lamp-server. And the task selector will go out and install Apache, MySQL, and PHP for you.
Oh, that's kind of...
And it'll just do a minimal setup. It'll run you through some guides. You set the root password for MySQL.
Right.
So it keeps it secure, and you're done.
That's interesting. So what's the benefit of using... why not just use apt? I mean, what would be the...
Well, this does use apt.
Okay. Well, I mean, initially. Okay. But
because they don't know. I mean, because they've never set up a LAMP server, and so the nice thing is this
it's fetching all the stuff for you, so you don't have to. That makes sense.
Okay.
And because it's Ubuntu, it's going to be well supported by a vendor, and it's well supported by VMware out of the box.
Right.
So you're deploying something that's got long term support. You're deploying something that has a high contractor support ratio. You're deploying something that's very easy to get LAMP installed with basic knowledge. And last but not least, you're deploying something that has really good VMware integration. So I think out of all of those things, OpenSUSE Enterprise Server or Ubuntu LTS would be my suggestion with the preference to Ubuntu LTS for what you guys need to do.
Good to know.
All right. Next email comes in from Erez. He says, Dear Matt and Chris, two thoughts on the last episode, Season 28, Episode 1. First, on the subject of Canonical crowdfunding project, Matt assumed that the project will reach a peak and then start to peter out. In the episode of NPR podcast Planet Money, and he links us to that, they showed that it's usually not the case that a graph is actually reversed, that with two peaks, one at the beginning and one at the end. So you got your big funding, then a lull, and then big funding.
Well, unless I'm forgetting what I said, I'm fairly certain that I said it would peter out, and then at the end someone's going to come in like Han Solo and a Millennium Falcon and basically drop a lump of some. And I'm not saying I may change that mind, but I believe that's what I said last week. I'd have to rewatch it to know for sure.
Chat rooms also pointing out that I didn't mention this, but one of the reasons, sorry to jump around.
Oh, yeah.
I mentioned OpenSUSE is because as a Windows admin shop, you guys might find Yast.
Right,
to get Apache up and going.
Yast is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so anyways.
I believe that's what I said last week is basically, you know, it was going to dip down, and then at that very last minute, there's going to be some serious fundage dropped. Now, that's not to say that's accurate, but I think that's what I said. I'm fairly certain.
All right. So, I think that's what you said, too.
It's not gospel. I'd have to look again. I don't remember. But
Second, on React OS, once you described it and actually how it looks and plays, I was somewhat disappointed. I always assumed the project was created to create a better OS that uses the Windows API and not duplicate Windows. Sort of a good implementation of the API. But your analysis made me think that I might be wrong here, that the API is tied to the GUI and you cannot implement it in a way that would not end up looking like a Windows GUI.
Exactly.
This is not surprising, assuming this is the case, since unlike Linux, Windows has a graphic rendering in the kernel, and so they could standardize many things by simply assuming everything will look the same and act the same. This feeling strengthened when you started mentioning that where they could diverge from Windows user experience, they did, and did improve on the original implementation. Love to hear what you think of this. I think you nailed it.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me.
Yeah, I don't know how much
I can't add to that.
But whenever you run a Windows app under Wine, it always kind of has that Windows look to it. It's really hard to kind of retheme all of that. Now you can apply textures on top of it, but that's a hack.
Well, and they're doing good work. I just, you know, I think they need to kind of figure out where they're going, because it just feels like it just becomes further and further behind the more they go. I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough. The only way I really see React OS long term working out is really when the Windows Empire is kind of the sun is set. People are not really actively developing for it anymore.
That would be a fix.
And then React OS can kind of catch up, and then React OS becomes that compatibility layer we all use to use those legacy
Win32 apps. That would be pretty cool, actually. Okay.
We'll see.
Yeah, could happen.
Jay writes in, and he wants us to revisit our thoughts on GNOME. Loving Last, been watching for a long time, and in the early days of GNOME, such as GNOME 3.0, I agree with a lot of the frustration remarks that were said, like the lack of power menu comes to mind. The more I use GNOME, and he's using version 3.8, the more I'm beginning to like it. As time goes on, I find that there are tremendous amount of rough edges within the KDE environment. The over-the-top colors that make me feel like I'm in an anime, and the up-and-down misalignment and rather small little things like text in the clock widget, etc., have caused me to really appreciate the aesthetics of GNOME 3.8. The integration of online accounts is great as well. I keep hearing that KDE is fabulous and amazing, and the truth be told, I think it is, but there are so many rough edges that I feel like GNOME is just edging ahead quite a few notches. The aesthetics I mentioned above, the lack of video streaming across SMB on a LAN, that's a huge one for me, and the lack of Exchange integration, et cetera, have all kind of amounted to my current stance. I'm curious if you guys revisited GNOME 3.8 and see if your previous three opinions would be any different with GNOME 3.8. Thanks for your time, Jay.
I haven't revisited lately, so I need to actually spend some time and do some common tasks that I would normally do under XFCE, which I'm really happy with, to see how that mirrors to it. I would agree with you on KDE, too. I think that it definitely has some fairly significant rough edges that are almost deal breakers in some instances.
I'm getting a private message from
No worries.
I switched from GNOME 3.8 to KDE 4.10. So I actually was running GNOME 3.8 at first, and I liked it a lot. The only major thing I came up with is I realized that, first of all, I'm not so sure the direction of the GNOME desktop. I'm still not fully comfortable there.
Right.
And I'm also not totally clear on the long-term viability of GTK versus Qt.
That's one area that I have concerns over. I'm not as concerned by it as I am watchful of it. I'm kind of waiting to see how that reacts, because I am seeing Qt really push forward with its development stuff, and I'm not seeing a lot in the GTK. And so I don't know. We'll have to see.
Yeah. I also just the amount of plugins that I need to get mm-hmm. working to make GNOME functional extensions kind of makes me nervous, and I'm worried that it's going to break. Whereas KDE, a lot of that's built in.
Yeah.
And I do suffer from KDE oddities. Like, I really am annoyed by the way it handles audio. About 6 or 7 days of uptime, for some reason, Dolphin becomes unmanageably slow to open and close. Open a file.
I almost wonder if there's some weird caching thing going on. Like, there's some big data file that's being piled into.
I can tell. You know, I've ran tracing tools, and I've ran IOTOP, and I don't see, like... So what I have happening, in fact, if anybody knows a fix to this, when I launch Dolphin or any Qt app that uses the standard KDE open and save dialog, mm-hmm. a minute to 2 minutes before it'll display, like on the click of the icon.
And see, I've seen that on XFCE, and there was a fix for it there, and I wonder if the same.
I don't know.
I'll have to check for
don't
that.
Know. Yeah. If I reboot, it goes away.
Right, yeah, same.
So that's odd. But I did a lot of discussion threads, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyways, before we go on, Minures. I think, I don't know, Minuez. He writes in, he says, hey, I just want to know if you guys saw this $99 Intel PC, or $199 Intel PC that's going on sale. They call it the Minnow board.
I've heard about it. I haven't really dug that deep into it, but I have heard of it.
It's going to be an open source PC that's supposed to sort of compete with the Arduino or the Raspberry Pi, I suppose.
That's cool.
Going to have an x86 processor on it, and I haven't really got a chance to look at it.
It could be interesting. Could be pretty cool. You know, it'd be nice if it had real, like, a deal breaking for the other guys. Differentiating.
I'm always
thing.
Skeptical of the Intel stuff. It always seems like, I don't know,
dollar short, too late.
Yeah, they're always too. They're always too late, and they're always promising these cool devices that never ship. And they're like, oh well, that was just an example. That was just a reference. Now maybe this one's different, right? I think that's actually
they're fighting to be relevant. I mean, with the decline of the desktop, as they say. I mean, they say I'm always on the fence on the.
No,
decline
but the
desktop,
one thing but, is for sure is there's a hell of a lot of ARM chips that are selling that they're not making any money on, right?
This is true. Yeah, this is true. So yeah.
All right. If you guys would like to send your feedback in, which we still have a bunch, but we'd love to hear from you. Email the Linux Action Show at jupiterbroadcasting.com, or you can find our bit message address in the show notes and send us an awesome bit message.
Yes.
There's also the subreddit over at linuxactionshow.reddit.com.
Always a good way to get a hold of us.
Matt, where should we send people to find you throughout the week?
We are actually on Monday going to be hosting a...
Oh, yeah.
You know, we got a little
contest. Yeah, the open source caption contest for opensource.com.
That's probably the best place to find us.
Yeah, we'll be tweeting that out and Google Plusing and all of that stuff. So that'll be on Monday. We'll be the judges.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly what time it is. It's in my calendar.
It's Monday afternoon,
at 1 or 2.
Like, somehow, some way... we're supposed to review 170 submissions or so.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm going to do all of that between this moment, Coda Radio, and all of that. I don't know exactly how that's all going to work out, but we will be doing that Sunday, and we're going to have a lot of fun. It'll be on a live Google Hangout session. You can find more info. I'll try to tweet it out when we start.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Stuff.
All right, everyone. Well, thanks so much for tuning this week's episode of the Linux Action Show. Easy for me to say,
Easy for you to say.
We'll see you right back here next week.
Oh, see, there we go.
This has
got to go. You can't put it in the recording.
Those look like woman boobs. Those when it Photoshop.
Well, you've been upgraded. Clearly.
When you Photoshop it, it looks like you put my head over a woman. It looks like a woman. Those look like except for the hair. Oh, okay. No. Oh, it's too much. It's too much.
Oh man, that's awesome.
Oh,
that woke me up. Jeez. Hello.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Ooh.
Little Mr. Sulu there. Oh, my. I'm just saying. Yep.
Shake it off. Shake it off. Shake it off.
Well, I'm not sleeping tonight.
All right, we got another.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, you guys.
Want to have the most fun you've ever had watching a game show? All you need is a set.
This is the new storage array, and these are the drives. So there's the drives.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and I got each drive marked with the person who sent it.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, and there it is, empty. There's the storage array thingy, empty.
Wow.
Another one from here. Let's see. This one's from Slips. Let's see if this is maybe a little more palatable. Oh, that's really good.
Actually, that's excellent. Okay, now that's very, very, very good.
Oh, Slips with the win.
Save that bad boy now.
All right, okay.
Because, you know, I'm still anything to unsee that other image.
Yeah, really?
I was like, ah.
I know. Now, does anybody have anything hot to kind of clean the palate? Because, woo.
Let's go back and Google some of those videos we were doing earlier.
That is great, though. That is a really good one.
Yeah, it was excellent.
Thanks, Slips. Exactly what I was thinking.
The other one, not so much.
Hey. Shake it off. Don't think about it, Matt. Don't think about it, Matt. Don't think about it.
Oh, wow.